and welcome to another new installment of The Two Brandons. This is Brandon Thomas.
And this is Brandon Easton.
And we would just like to start off today's show saying Happy New Year to, to all of our listeners out there. We apologize for the brief hiatus. There's been a lot of exciting stuff going on with us professionally and also personally. So it took us a little while to circle back around. But given the big announcement that happened earlier this week, the official unveiling of the cast, or the principal cast for the new Star Wars movie, upcoming Episode 7, directed by J.J. Abrams, written by J.J. and Lawrence Kasdan, who, as many big Star Wars heads know, was responsible for The Empire Strikes Back, which a lot of us view as the high water mark of the franchise. So,
and Lee Brackett. Don't forget Lee Brackett.
All right. Yeah, I shouldn't. Shout out to Lee. So, given that, you know, we just had to talk about it. As soon as the news came out, I contacted Easton. I said, all right, this is the time. We need to do it now. So, we are going to start off talking about that. I don't know if I've probably told this story a couple of times. Don't know if I've told it on The Two Brandons or just during some of my ambidextrous columns. But Star Wars is a very big, important thing for me personally. I think it's pretty safe to say that without Star Wars, I wouldn't even be here. I wouldn't have wanted to pursue this dream of being a professional writer and creating my own stories and characters and worlds. And for me, getting Star Wars on that VHS cassette from my grandmother was like that was pretty much it for me. Like, after that, I was completely gone down the rabbit hole, never to return. So Star Wars is very, very, very important to me personally. And like many people, I had initial mixed feelings when the announcement was made that George Lucas had sold all of the rights to Disney. Nothing particularly against Disney, but, you know, I think that a lot of people are nursing kind of some a little disappointment in the prequels. And so this announcement that there were going to be new Star Wars movies were something that I was initially hesitant about, a little less hesitant after J.J. Abrams was announced as the writer-director, because as we've spoke at length about this before when discussing his Star Trek reboots, it's clear that he loves Star Wars, you know.
Yes.
without getting into the whole, you know, is Star Wars, is Star Trek now Star Wars, all that stuff has been beat to death. But when they announced that they had convinced him with some effort to take control of it, I got a little cautiously optimistic. And with this announcement last week, you know, I think I could say I'm officially excited about it. That said, I thought that there's a lot to unpack, given the announcement of the new cast. So a lot of this will be a little speculation, a little kind of wishful thinking. But Easton, like, what were your initial impressions when you saw the cool cast photo?
Man, it was something I was waiting for quite some time. I'm a big Star Wars fan, too. Unlike you, however, my Star Trek and Star Wars fandom pretty much, occupies the exact same space in my mind. Yeah, I mean, it's exciting. I mean, I can't have any other feeling than complete excitement and joy. I mean, I've been willing to jettison all the negative feelings I have, mainly toward the Phantom Menace and the not so much with Attack of the... I mean, Attack of the Clones wasn't great either, but as we both discussed in the past, I really like Episode 3 a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm ready for a new trilogy. I'm ready to see... in a lot of ways, this is what I've been waiting for since 1983. I wanted to know what happened to Luke, Leia, Han, and Lando, and, you know, everybody. And I've enjoyed the expanded universe immensely. But I was ready for some movies that took place after Return of the Jedi, and we're going to get them. And I have nothing negative to say about the casting, about anything. I'm just waiting to see how it comes out. And that's only because I still look at it from the perspective of not knowing enough about the situation. I mean, we've had a lot of fans already complaining complaining about gender this and diversity that. And I'm like, look, you know, I get it. It's important to have that, but we don't know enough. This is just the main cast.
Right.
There will be a secondary cast.
Right.
Just like
these are not the only people that will be in the movie.
Right. And it gets back to this whole geek entitlement where fandom today feels as if though they are somehow a part of the production process. They seem to believe that if you whine and bitch and complain enough beforehand, those producers who really don't give a damn about what you feel are going to change their minds and say, boy, you know what? Because everybody's complaining, let's put more women on the main cast of Star Wars, Episode 7. Or because all these people are complaining, let's get rid of Ben Affleck as Batman. I mean, it's like, right. That's not going to change. So in the meantime, instead of being upset or angst-ridden, I'm going to just wait and see what is going to happen. I mean, that's a novel concept, folks. Let's just wait and see. We don't know. We have none of us here, and I can guarantee nobody listening to this, hopefully somebody, but generally speaking, whoever's listening to this is not working at Lucasfilm. Right now, they are not working at Lucasfilm. And I can guarantee that the 20 or 30 people who've actually seen the screenplay, they really don't care what anybody else thinks. You know, so when you go into it with that perspective and basic understanding, you just have to wait. I'm just waiting for the first teaser trailer.
Right.
I'm going to jump out of my seat just like back in 1998 when I first saw the teaser trailer for Star Wars Episode 1. I mean, come on, folks. I mean, we're getting more Star Wars and people are already fucking complaining.
Yeah.
It's like, stop it. Please, for the love of Christ, just wait. Let's just wait to see what's going to happen.
Yeah.
That's all. I mean, I'm really excited about this.
I mean,
you know,
I look at it like this. I mean, I understand we both understand the need for representation. Right. We understand the push for representation, but I was really a little, you know, disheartened to see that everything, every step of the production process of these movies has become so public now, and it is debated and dissected, which is cool. But what I don't think is right is that it's debated and it's dissected in such a negative connotation. You know, where if people would just say, hey, look, you know, this is a concern I have, but to be honest, I don't know shit yet. And a lot of us don't know shit. So it might not be exactly what we're thinking. It may not be like, you know, the apocalyptic mess that, you know, everyone has decided it's already going to be because of a single cast photo. I mean, seriously.
You are right. I'm agreeing with you.
Seriously. Shit. I mean, I understand. We are two black male geeks that, you know, are also crazy or stupid enough to try to do this professionally. So I understand. I don't want this to seem like I'm completely invalidating any and all discussion in regards to Star Wars and how many, you know, females are in it, how many white males are in it versus everybody else. But, you know, I also think that it's clear that this movie, Episode 7, is going to serve as somewhat of a bridge between, you know, the old Star Wars and what is going to become the new Star Wars. So, I mean, when you have when they announced this cast and six or seven of the actors were previously in the in the trilogy that we all know and love, I mean, there isn't much space for new characters in Episode 7 anyway. Clearly, I mean, if you want to spend some time, you know, catching up with Luke and Leia and Han and R2-D2 and C-3PO and Chewbacca. I mean, all of these actors are going to be in this movie in some kind of significant way. But I don't think that's going to be the case forever. I mean, Disney has already, you know, revealed that they want to keep making Star Wars movies for quite a while. And I do not believe that, it, you know, as these movies progress, that we're just going to get, like, the same white all-male cast that, you know, we kind of have now. And to me, what makes me excited about it is, if, I mean, two of the youngest, you know, members in that cast photo, John Boyega and I forgot Daisy's last name already, I'm sorry. The actress that it's heavily speculated will play, you know, the daughter of Han and Leia. It appears to me like these are two of the youngest people in this cast. So essentially, these are going to be your main characters in the Star Wars saga going forward. Like, right. These are going to be the actors that are anchoring these movies far into the future after we do our Star Wars revival here or whatever we're doing. And the fact that, you know, the fact that we may have a young black Jedi and a young female Jedi taking the reins of this franchise for the next 10 years, for me, that's a little more important and a little more relevant than, you know, seeing, you know, I mean, maybe the diversity that we would like in this initial movie. You know, to me, I'm always looking forward, you know.
Right.
Looking forward, you know, all these old people are going to be moved out and replaced with the new kids. Now, if they replace all of the new kids with a bunch of, you know, white male actors, you know, then I can understand why some people are being very critical up front. But the way that I see it, there is a very real chance that we have a black Jedi and a black female Jedi or adventurer or princess. I don't know if she's going to be a Jedi. I hope so. But these are going to be the characters that are taking the reins for this franchise far into the future. And I don't know if I'm just crazy, but, you know, I know there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, like, where's Lando? Like, where's, you know, Billy Dee Williams?
Yes.
You know, I understand that. I would like to see Lando again. I would like to see him mentioned or referenced or him at least appear or be talked about. Hopefully he's not dead. You know, that would be a whole other thing. But I'm much more interested in, you know, I'm much more interested in Skywalkers. I want diverse main characters more than I want a bunch of diverse supporting characters that don't really do much or are trapped in the background, you know, for the entire next trilogy or whatever it is they're doing. To me, that's more important. I mean, I looked at that picture and I'm like, yeah, you know, there's a lot of white people here, but, you know, seven of these white people were here already. I mean, what are we going to do about it? You know, like, Mark Hamill is white and male. Harrison Ford is white and male. I mean, should we have just, I mean, I guess they could have just started over and, you know, and not, never even featured any of the older characters and just kind of referenced them in dialogue or whatever. But
right.
I think it is important for, you know, to make a bridge between the old Star Wars fans and what will hopefully be the new Star Wars fans clear into the future. And I think that we just don't know enough about the story, and we don't know enough about casting developments that are probably still in the process or haven't been finalized. Or I think people should be patient. I think that Lucasfilm has proven with the Clone Wars, with the expanded universe, that they do have some interest in diversifying the Star Wars galaxy, you know, given space and time. So I don't think that we should take this first cast photo, you know, of and half of it's filled with, you know, the older characters and start saying that, like, you know, it's a hugely missed opportunity and, you know, I'm not gonna go see it, I'm not gonna support it. And, you know, I don't know. I know it's a waste of time, even when I say it, you know, to encourage people to be reasonable and to be patient and to just, you know, kind of let things develop at their own pace. You know, I know it's a waste of breath, but I feel like I should say it anyway. Like, I don't know, does that make me crazy or nuts? I'm not sure. But to me, just thinking about, you know, a generation of kids, a generation of, you know, of black kids and a generation of young girls that might possibly be able to watch Star Wars movies, where there are people like them that are the main characters, that are the potential driving force of the narrative. I mean, I get chills when I think about, you know, being able to see like a young black Jedi like on screen. I mean, I don't know.
What do I pick up from that? Well, first, Daisy Ridley is the name of the actress. Daisy Ridley is probably going to be playing the daughter, and we're speculating, the daughter of Han Solo and Princess Leia. That's a big speculation.
Yes.
Now, you said it all. I mean, first of all, the Star Wars trilogy, the original one was made during a time, and we're talking like this 1970s were like days of segregation. But generally speaking, in 1976, when George Lucas was filming the original Star Wars film, he actually did plan on Han Solo being black. A lot of people don't know this. This is one of those old school Star Wars hidden stories. But he actually has mentioned, and you can, you know, research this online yourself, he actually had considered having Han Solo be black, but for some reason he, you know, made the decision to hire Harrison Ford, who he had a previous working relationship with, from American Graffiti.
Yeah.
And it also turns out that Harrison Ford was a carpenter who got, you know, hooked up into the film industry because of his connections with other film producers, because Harrison Ford was helping build something at a producer's house. And that's where that trademark scar on Harrison Ford's chin comes from his days as a carpenter, not from the Indiana Jones whip, as they would have you believe. So that's number one. But yeah, first of all, there's no way you were going to be able to make a brand new Star Wars trilogy that takes place after Return of the Jedi within their, you know, chronology and not have the original cast in it in some way. It just doesn't make any possible sense for that to be the case.
Right.
So I don't have an issue with that, and I'm willing to accept the reality of the storytelling. Once again, none of us know where this is going to go. You know, but the idea of having a black male Jedi and a white female Jedi or adventurer or whatever the case may be going for, I mean, this is going to be pretty amazing any way you cut it. So I don't particularly have a reason to feel bad about anything. You know, in the meantime, let's just continue to enjoy it. And I like the expanded universe, even though they're going to be getting rid of it, sort of. And I can accept that. The thing is, and I've said this before, and if this is the first time you're listening to us, you know, welcome. But go back and listen to some of our older episodes. I've said over the years that my own fandom has gotten cooler in the sense that I'm not as irritable or angry or knee-jerk as I used to be. And one of the things that caused me to calm down was actually working in Hollywood. When you see how things are made and what the decisions are, you're a lot less likely to start bitching and complaining about every little thing that doesn't go your way. And I wish that every geek out there could just take a film economics course or an economics of Hollywood course so they understand why things are done. It would basically turn the internet off because people wouldn't have anything to bitch about. But if folks did that, they would understand how and why certain decisions are made. There are situations where there are way too many white folks in a movie. Like, for example, the Noah's Ark movie that just came out with, you know, now, and you know, I was raised Catholic. Where they say the Ark crashed at is on the top of Mount Ararat in Turkey, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And last time I checked, the people in that part of the world are brown. So I'm wondering how on earth, if there was a great flood that started in the Middle East and then the ark floated across the continent of what of Africa and then landed in, you know, the Ottoman Empire, which is Turkey, basically, how is it every person in that film was white? That doesn't make any sense to me. So that is the kind of thing where I think people should say, hey, this doesn't make any sense. Because if you are in the least bit religious, and I don't care if you're Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, Jewish, whatever the case may be, the core of most global religions is centered around a tiny spot between Israel and Egypt. And once again, the last time I checked, those people are brown. So being mad about Star Wars diversity to me is stupid when there's plenty of other stuff in terms of non-diverse casting that we could be talking about, you know, like the average CBS sitcom, you know. <It's> like, I mean, they have How I Met Your Mother, and then they have like this new show about I Got my Best Friends, or My Friends Are Better Than Me, some show with James Vanderbeek.
Friends with Better Lives.
Yeah, some crap like that. There's not a black person on that show. And I'm like, this is the stuff I'm talking about, because all these shows take place in major American cities.
And they're created today.
Right.
They were created last year.
Right. So, you know, people getting mad about Star Wars casting without having the benefit of any knowledge of the script or the story or anything is stupid to me. And I'm going to say it. I get... No, because Brandon's a lot nicer than me. Brandon Thomas is much... He's much nicer than me. When he said that he wasn't going to, you know, disregard or invalidate these discussions about diversity, I'm going to disregard and invalidate them because we don't know enough information about it yet. If the film comes out and that young lady gets two lines of dialogue and there's nothing but white dudes running around blowing up stuff, then, you know what? I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. I'm like, all right, you know what? That was wrong. But right now, it's still too early.
I mean, those white dudes might not even be alive at the end of the movie.
See, and that's another factor that I think a lot of Star Wars fans are not considering. Some people, and I'm saying this as a fan, I'm bracing my own self for the potential death, on-screen deaths of those characters that we absolutely adore. Because it's quite possible that Harrison Ford, Han Solo, or Princess
Mark
Leia,
Hamill.
Or you know, or Luke himself. Luke is my favorite character, actually.
Yes.
If Luke died, like Luke could conceivably die the same way Obi-Wan died at the end of Episode 4, the original Star Wars film. So think about that. Think about the fact that the people that we really like might not make it to the end credits of Episode 7.
Right.
That's more of the thing I think people should be thinking about. There are three films coming. Not to mention the in-between movies
right.
that are supposed to
be. In-between films.
Right. Who knows what's coming? Maybe we'll see Lando's daughter and she's or son or nephew. They're probably going to be black. You know?
I would imagine.
You know, I mean, or like mixed or something. They look like Eddie Murphy's kids. I mean, who knows? But the point being is that we don't know what's going to happen. And I can guarantee even a year out, that at least one of our beloved characters is not going to make it through to the end of Episode 7. I mean, it wouldn't make sense to keep all those people alive. So right. Somebody's got to check out.
Right.
I don't know who. I mean, the odds-on favorite would be Luke because he has to pass. It has to be. Some, I guarantee because it's J.J. Abrams, there's going to be some big shock moment somewhere in that third act where everybody's going to be like, oh my God, no! And it'll probably be the death of Luke. I hope not, but...
I hope we can have him around a little longer, but...
But
you know.
Story logic would dictate, in order to move the Jedi story forward, Luke has to go.
Somebody got to go.
And it has to be Luke. It would make sense, because whoever John Boyega is playing is probably going to be the heir apparent to the Jedi Order. Or in some way tasked with rebuilding or continuing the New
it's
Republic.
Just how, think of how cool that's going to be. Think of what that's going to mean, potentially.
Dude, in Episode 8 and 9, we'll have a black male Jedi hero. Something we would have never as kids imagined on screen. I mean, that's where... Anyway, I just feel like we just got to wait and calm down.
Right.
You know? Because even with the Batman, Superman, or Justice League, whatever this movie is going to be called, you know, Ben Affleck probably is not my first choice to play Batman. But guess what? Neither was Michael Keaton in 1989. You know, when Michael Keaton was cast, I remember this, people were, this is before the internet. Yeah. People were pissed off at comic book shops and Starlog magazine. People were writing two-page letters.
Wasn't there like a petition that somebody took out in a major magazine or newspaper or something?
Yeah, it was either Starlog or People or some major magazine that said that we don't want Mr. Mom playing Batman. It was something along those lines. And I remember thinking, boy, this is going to suck. This guy's a comedy actor. And man, he got up on stage and blew, man, he played the hell out of Bruce Wayne.
Yep.
He was a damn good Batman. I believed he was Batman. I believed it. And as someone who loved Michael Keaton's comedies, like Beetlejuice and all that other stuff he did, I didn't think he had it in him. But I was a kid and I was stupid. And that's my point. A lot of people still have the mindset of a stupid 14-year-old or 13-year-old kid who can't get over the fact that Hollywood did something they didn't like. Well, guess what? They're never going to do what you like. And when you get over that, you'll be much happier like me. I don't get mad about anything anymore. Like, when it comes to movies and stuff, look, I'm one of the world's biggest Transformers fans. I really am. I don't talk about it like I used to because I got over it. But I'm still a huge Transformers fan. That new Transformers movie looks absolutely horrible. They've got Optimus Prime riding on the back of Grimlock.
Right.
I mean, like, seriously? Like, when I saw that, I said, you know what? The old Brandon would have jumped up and ran toward the screen like Peter Griffin and tried to punch it. You know, Brandon's not doing that anymore. I looked at it. I said, this is stupid. I posted one thing on Facebook saying how stupid it was, and I've left it alone. I have nothing else to say. If they want Optimus Prime to ride, Michael Bay wants Optimus Prime to ride on the back of Grimlock like, you know, like a horse. Hey, hey. I mean, in the history of the Transformers, comics, novels, and TV shows, Optimus Prime has never ridden on the back of a Dinobot. But if Michael Bay wants to do that, let him do it. It's not going to affect me because I still have all the Transformers stuff that came before Michael Bay. Right. And I'm happy with that. And that's kind of my point, that if the people here are so pissed off that there's not enough young women, or particularly young white women, being cast in the Star Wars
you
movie,
know what?
That's what it really is.
I wasn't going to say it.
That's in my mind, if the only way, first of all, let's get this clear. When people say there's not enough women, they're not talking about women of color. They only want to see white women. So there's not enough white women cast for some people's taste. That's all it really is. And it's like, you know, hey, get over it. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. You know, and it's like, for example, I didn't like those racist robots in Transformers 2. So therefore, I was like, well, I'm not giving Michael Bay. If those of you haven't seen the second Transformers movie,
Please, there were
these two robots called Mudflaps and Skids, and they were literally like those black crows from Dumbo. Like, it was literally those same characters, but in robot form. Right. They just were like acting like street niggas, excuse my language, but that's what they were. And apparently Michael Bay and company thought that was funny. Well, somebody thought that was funny. So the bottom line is, if something you don't like, you don't have to go see it. That's another factor that people don't really talk about too much anymore. If you're so angry, don't see it. If you're going to be so offended, you know, stay home. You could just watch the original trilogy a million times, which didn't have very many white women in it. You know, so, you know, if you want to complain, you know, complain. You know, I don't know. I'm just ready to see what comes now. You know, I'm not going to argue. You know, Kathleen Kennedy, who is in charge of Lucasfilm, does not care what any of us think. She's a brilliant woman. She's a smart woman. She's worked her way up to the top, and she's worked her way up to the top because she knows what makes good movies and what doesn't. Few people on Earth ever get to her position in their prospective industries. I'm going to trust her. I'm going to trust J.J. Abrams. Now that George Lucas's influence is pretty much gone,
right,
we've got younger people with younger ideas who understand 21st century storytelling a little bit better than George Lucas did. No disrespect to Lucas, but he was stuck in a very older way of telling stories. And the prequel trilogy, as we all could see, suffered heavily from that lack of innovation in terms of storytelling. J.J. Abrams, love him or hate him, is an excellent visual storyteller. So he's a Star Wars fan. He's working with Lawrence Kasdan. He's working with Kathleen Kennedy. He's working with the rest of the Lucasfilm's talented editorial team and creative team. I have no doubt this is going to be mind-blowing, and I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt. And that's all I have to say about Star Wars right now.
Awesome. Last thing I want to say, just piggybacking on what you just said about JJ, you know, people, I just don't understand why people just don't have memories. I mean, I know that JJ and company, and rightfully so, took a lot of heat for some of that, you know, some of that shit they pulled in Star Trek Into Darkness, where, you know, they had the yes. doctor standing around in her underwear for no reason at all. But, you know, people also forget, it's like, J.J. Abrams created Alias. J.J. Abrams created Felicity. J.J. Yep. Abrams was a creator on Undercovers, which featured two black leads. It did get canceled, but I mean, just because, you know, people just want to act like they don't remember shit. And I really do not believe, I have seen no evidence that JJ is going to go out of his way to exclude either white women or women of color permanently from the Star Wars movies that he's going to be making for the next 10 years of his life, probably. I mean, I just don't believe that. I believe that, you know, that given time and given where the story is going to go, I think that it is going to present plenty of opportunities to increase the level of diversity in the Star Wars universe. And I do not think that the way that the cast looks in episode 7 is going to be the same way that it looks in episode 9 or 10. Like, I don't believe that. If that's true, then I would say that, you know, this discussion is completely, completely merited and warranted. But like you said, we don't know enough yet. And I just, the thing that I hate how, like, these casting decisions have become as important as the script. Because bottom line, if the script is garbage, if the story is unengaging or stupid, who gives a fuck who's cast in the movie?
Like, yeah, there you go.
I mean, I don't understand why casting has taken on such, you know, an elevated importance. Where it's like, casting is just one element of the formula. But if you have a horrible script, I mean, just look at, I haven't seen it yet, so I'm not going to dog it out too much, but Amazing Spider-Man 2, you know, Amazing Spider-Man 2, by all accounts.
Oh, you saw it?
I haven't seen it yet. Oh, okay, but okay. Based on the word on the street, it's not too great. And some people would say that the first Amazing Spider-Man, you know, wasn't too great. And just think of that movie. Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone are a great, great, fantastic, I think, Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy, both yes. separately and together. But if the fucking script is falling to pieces, what does that mean? That just right. means that now everyone is saying that, well, you know, if it wasn't Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone in it, this movie wouldn't even be watchable. You know, to me, that's horrible. That's a horrible state of affairs if that is actually true. So, you know, it's the script and it's the story that is going to basically rule the day and dictate exactly how far this whole thing is going to go. So if JJ and Lawrence's script is garbage, it's not going to matter if it's a bunch of white dudes, you know, on the screen. It's just, it's not going to matter. The script, the story has to be good. It has to be good. So, I mean, just please relax. And I know, I feel like that's like the word I've said the most, like during the entire, you know, two brand. If you've listened to all of these, the word I think I say more than anything is just relax. Just relax. We don't know. We don't know enough yet. Clearly the cast is not done. And then another thing. And then don't try to take credit for shit either. Because when they do a next round of casting and there's like, you know, two female characters in it, right. don't take credit for it. Don't be like, the internet made them do it. No. Just, you know, just sit down, relax. It's all gonna work out in the end.
Right.
And I think based on the people that are involved and based on what Lucasfilm has done with the Star Wars, you know, expanded universe and the comics, the books, the cartoons are filled with kick-ass female characters. And I do not believe that they're just going to completely ignore that, you know, now that it's movie time. It's like, exactly. Oh, we've had all these female characters in these, you know, these cartoons and comics and stuff. But now, you know, now that we got the movies back again, it's just going to be a bunch of white dudes being heroes.
That's not going to happen.
I don't believe that's going to happen. I don't think J.J. Abrams would allow that to happen. I don't think Kathleen Kennedy would allow that to happen. And bottom line, Disney's not going to allow that to happen, because that's going to prevent them from making money and Bam. From marketing this new wave of Star Wars products that we're about to be drowning in for the next 10 years. It's just people, like, if the shit sounds like it doesn't make sense or it's probably not true, then it probably isn't.
Right.
So that's it. That's all I got about Star Wars Episode 7, and we'll see what happens, and hopefully it'll be good, and I'm sure we'll all be, you know, jumping out of our seats the first time they release a tiny, tiny little piece of footage.
Exactly.
I mean, exactly. Dude, the first time I see John Boyega with a lightsaber, I'm going to just pass out. I'm just telling everybody that right now. Awesome. I'm going to just pass out for the day, and it's just going to be like, that's just it for me. I mean, because I can't imagine myself being like 7 years old and seeing something like that. I mean, just to know how much I love Star Wars, to be able to see that, you know, as a kid, I mean, it's just, you can't quantify how important that is. You know?
Yeah, and I say that from the perspective from these kids don't know how good they're going to have it. You know, it's kind of like being born or being raised during the Obama years. Like, when I was a kid, the concept of a black president, for better or for worse, was just absolutely absurd. Like, it would not happen until, like, 2099 or something like that. But, you know, we're living under the administration of a black president, and in a lot of ways, it's very interesting that these young genre fans are going to grow up having black and Latino and women of all backgrounds as heroes. I mean, they just don't know how good they got it.
No.
You know, just kids today, man, if any of you listen to this somehow, hopefully not because there's been a lot of cursing, but understand that you guys have got it great. You guys, you're going to enjoy it. You guys and gals, you're going to really, oh man, to see a black Jedi period that's not Sam Jackson is going to be awesome.
Exactly. Because, you know, it's Sam Jackson, but it's really just Sam Jackson. With a lightsaber.
With a lightsaber, exactly.
This will actually be like a character, like an actual character in the Star Wars universe. It's not
exactly,
just like
a real character.
It's not just like, who let Jules onto the set and gave him this purple stick thing? What's going on here?
I want a purple lightsaber.
Right. This party is over.
Anyway.
Okay, so moving on. See, we missed this. So moving on, we're gonna move on to some personal business. We want to talk about. Hopefully, a lot of you already know this, but if you don't, my esteemed co-host and compatriot, Mr. Easton, just received an Eisner nomination for best single issue for Watson and Holmes issue 6. Which was illustrated by N. Stephen Harris, who's a friend of both of us. He did Voltron with me for a little while.
Good man, very good man.
Yeah, he's a good man. I love him. He's a good dude. He's a talented artist, hardworking, and I'm just like to publicly congratulate the both of you on the nominations. Well deserved, and you know, I already voted for you, so. You know,
thank you. I appreciate that. I
know
we're
supposed to keep that a secret or something, but you know. I voted for you, so I just wanted to talk a little bit about that, like how you found out, like where you were when you found out, and kind of how this whole thing, kind of like the reveal and the process kind of happened.
Okay, well, we'll start with the actual Eisner nomination, and then we can get into the development of the issue itself. I'd be happy to talk about that.
All right.
Okay, well, it was about, it was the middle of March, I want to say, or the end of March, and we got a email from the folks over at Comic-Con International who actually run the Eisner Awards ceremony and, you know, part of the judging, you know, process, all that stuff. So we got an email, and it said, oh, by the way, you were nominated for Watson and Holmes number 6 was nominated for Best Single Issue or One Shot, and Watson and Holmes the series itself was nominated for Best New Series for an Eisner. And, you know, mad props and congratulations go to Carl Ballers and Paul Mendoza, Brandon Perlow, and the rest, and Zach Rosenberg, as well as Justin Gabry. This is the, at the time, that was the core staff of New Paradigm Studios. So all those cats are awesome. And they sent our information out, and they told us to keep it quiet. So I got the information, and I was running. I mean, I have a pretty decent sized apartment, but I was running along the walls, man, like the Flash. that's how fast I was running. I could actually go vertical on a wall. It was pretty crazy. Sweet. And I had to keep it inside. And then I posted some big time teases on Facebook about some huge news that I was going to reveal. Yeah, I mean, everybody saw that one. About another week and a half later, on that Tuesday following the original email, Comic-Con International released their press release, and they sent us another email saying, okay, our press release is live. You guys can hype it as much as you like. And that's basically what happened. I did what I had to do, and I put it out there, and the response has been pretty cool. I mean, a lot of people have been congratulating me and sending me messages. There hasn't really been any industry shift in terms of any offers or anyone saying, hey, you know, what's going on? We'd like to give you an interview. We'd like to give you some work or whatever. Yeah. But that's okay. I mean, that might come, that might not come.
I think that'll definitely come with time, the closer right. we get to it, and the more, you know, kind of politicking that starts. I think that, I definitely think that it should be a huge, huge thing that's able to propel both of you guys into the back half of the year, because it means something. It means right. something. You know, it carries weight. It's something that validates your work and kind of how your career is going. So I think that I have no doubt that it will turn into big exciting things for you and Steven both going forward. And I'm really looking forward to that because you guys deserve it. So,
well, thank you. I mean, I really appreciate those words, man. And, in all seriousness, again, thank you. I'm still a little bit shocked about it. It's still sinking in. I mean, I never thought I'd be nominated for an Eisner, to be honest with you, because I felt as though it wasn't the most democratic process, but it turns out it might be the very only democratic process that exists now that I actually know more about it and how it works. It's amazing. I mean, I have to thank the judges for even nominating me for this, and, you know, we'll just see where it goes as far as that's concerned. Now how I got on to Watson at Home number 6 is it has to be almost 2 years now, because it was a while ago. I had met with Brandon Perlow at Midtown Comics in Manhattan, and he had heard about me from Shadow Law, and we had discussed some stuff, and we all knew the same people. And he said, hey, would you like to do a one-shot? Because the first 5 issues of Watson and Holmes is actually one story, and that's now collected into a trade paperback called A Study in Black, which is written by Carl Ballers, and artwork with Rick Leonardi. Beautiful artwork, as well as some cover art and pinup art by Walt Simonson, of all people. You know?
I believe Larry Stroman did.
And Larry Stroman, yes. Yes, absolutely, yeah. And, I mean, it's worth the attention it's gotten. I wish that every store had the wherewithal to order it, but the people who have ordered it have all said that the customers have loved it, and I love it. And I loved it before anybody even offered me anything, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So it was an honor to be asked. So what happened was, I worked with Justin Gabry and Zach Rosenberg, who were the editors and assistant editors, and, you know, do some other stuff over at New Paradigm Studios. I believe Justin Gabry has moved on since, but he was very helpful. I came up with an outline because I knew it was going to be a procedural story, and it takes place in about a week or so. But it had to be a self-contained mystery story. Now, I had never in my life written a mystery story, ever. Mm-hmm. That's not my strength. I've never been able to really come up with, you know, a compelling mystery hook in my entire life. So this was the first time I ever challenged myself to do a mystery. So I felt that because Watson and Holmes, in its very inception, and for those who don't know, Watson and Holmes is a retelling of the Sherlock Holmes mythos, but with a black Holmes and Watson set in modern Harlem. So it's very, very, very unique. It's very interesting. It's very innovative. Carl Ballas and company have done a remarkable job with building that universe. So when I had a chance to read the first few issues, I thought about some stuff that I saw when I was a teacher, and I actually used to teach in Harlem at Thurgood Marshall Academy up on 135th and Lenox. I think it was Lenox. I don't remember. It was a long time ago. Anyway, so the point is that I used to teach over in Harlem, and there were things I saw in the community that was very interesting, particularly the gentrification of Harlem. Now, I don't think in our lifetime or anybody's lifetime we'll ever see Harlem revert back into being a Dutch colony. But there are more white folks in Harlem now than I have ever seen in my entire life. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's just a statement of fact. I've never seen this many white people living in Harlem before. And it's interesting because it's one of those situations where you actually have what America should look like. I mean, you've got blacks, Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, all kind of folks living in Harlem together. And there's no problems. I mean, this is what America should be. Mm-hmm. And I felt that I should make sure that the actual events of the story take place in Central Harlem. So I made up some politician, and I made up that his wife got killed. And the real trick of the story, I'm not going to ruin it for those who haven't read it yet, but the trick of the story is how the wife died and who actually was responsible for the death and what's the story behind that. So I will say that I brought in issues of, you know, sex trafficking, human trafficking of that and things of that nature. And I wanted to shed some light on that because I have a background in sociology, and I didn't realize how bad sex trafficking actually is. I mean, there's still slavery on Earth right now. It ain't just something that happened to black folks a long time ago. I mean, there are young men and women of all backgrounds that are being trafficked for sexual purposes across the planet, across our country, across our state lines, in every city right now. I mean, if one thing that show, Dateline had that series called To Catch a Predator, which was one of the greatest shows I've ever seen, and that showed America that these people are everywhere, pedophiles and disgusting sex predators. These guys are all over the place. And I wanted to tell a story about how that impacts the modern world and how it impacts even New York City, which is a major, unfortunately, sex trafficking corridor. So with all that in mind, I came up with a story that was a mystery, that was a procedural, and it came out and people liked it. But, man, the nomination is still blowing my mind. So that's how that came about. I mean, I was just approached out the blue by Brandon Perlow, and the rest is history, as they say.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I mean, it's a great issue. It's a great story. It's a great topic that definitely needs more light and attention shed on it. And, you know, I wish you guys luck. I'll be there. I don't know. You know, I've never actually been to the actual Eisner ceremony, but this year I will actually go.
It's Friday night.
That's okay. I live here now. I'm making that.
right.
I'm making that commitment. This will be the first year that I actually go to the ceremony. So
I've never gone either.
Well, you have to go to, you know.
Right.
Clearly.
Yeah exactly. Well, you know, I never thought it was something that everybody was invited to. I thought that you had to be invited to that show.
No, I think it's pretty much, I think if you have a ticket to Comic-Con, I think you're pretty much welcome to come. I think that it's kind of one of those things where I don't know if the attendance, like, I don't know, it's probably not like getting into Hall H. Like, it's probably not a difficult seat to get. But I'm pretty sure you just need your badge from Comic-Con and you can just walk in. So
that's cool. It's good to know.
Are you gonna get all dressed up? You gonna get all suited up?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, it's hot in San Diego in August or July.
Well, it's hot today, so I'm just imagining what it's going to be like in July.
Oh, my God. Isn't it hot in SoCal right now? It's ridiculous.
I know. Poor babies, right?
Right. I like rain. But what I was going to say, though, now, I don't know if I'm going to dress up. I'll probably wear a shirt and tie and something nice, but I don't want to get all dressed up and not win. Uh-huh. And I feel real stupid because now I have to walk around in a suit and tie when everybody else is dressed like Voltron or Judge Dredd or, you know, some obscure anime person. But no, I don't know. I mean, be real with you. I definitely will, you know, look nice. I'll make sure I'm clean shaven or whatever. But we'll see. I mean, I'm going to be there, and I know Hannibal and a bunch of other folks are going to show up to support. So this will be a great night for all of us. And if I win, then it'll be a really great night for all of us.
Yes. Yes, it'll be a fantastic night. I don't even know the numbers. We'll have to do some research to see if it doesn't. I don't want to speak in too many generalities, but I don't think a black writer has ever won an Eisner. I'll have to double check that. That may not be correct.
Yeah, Hannibal had the numbers of who was nominated.
Okay.
And in terms of winning, I don't know.
Okay.
I think Kyle Baker won once.
That's true. He might have won for like best artist or like right. best like artist or anchor or something. You're right. Kyle Baker probably did win. So, okay.
Yeah, but I don't think Dwayne McDuffie was ever nominated, which is strange.
I don't believe so. Which yeah. is a tragedy. But I don't believe he ever was. But we'll put a bookmark in that and do some research on that. Or maybe someone listening will hear this and do the research for it.
Well, right now I am on the site. And I'm looking up for I'm on Wikipedia right now, and I'm looking up winners, and I'm trying to see like the most recent people. Best writer, artist, Jeff Darren. No. Kyle Baker has won for Plastic Man for like 3 years in a row for best writer, artist for humor.
Okay.
Kyle Baker also won in 1999 for that Vertigo book, You Are Here.
Yep.
And let's see. There may be some other black folks whose names aren't, you know, quote unquote black enough. So I don't know if these people, I don't know what a lot of these people look like. But I do know certain names, and I'm not seeing them. And I know that one of the Love Brothers was nominated for something last year.
Oh, yeah, for Bayou, probably.
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah, we've had nominations. But other than, from what I'm seeing here, other than Kyle Baker, I'm not seeing too many other black folks at all.
I think that overall this year, as far as, I think the Eisners did a pretty good job as far as, being representative of comics. I mean, you and Watson and Holmes got a nomination. I know Kelly Sue DeConnick got a lot of nominations, well-deserved. So, like you said, it seems like the Eisner nominations are a little more inclusive than the actual kind of ranks, creative ranks for mainstream comics. So it could be that, you know, there is some steady progress being made on that front. And that's good to see. And I'm just, you know, I'm glad that you get to be a part of it. And like I said, this will be the first time I actually show up to the Eisner. So.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it, bro. I mean, I think we'll all have a really good time, and it'll be good to see everybody, too, because for those of you out there, you know, a lot of times a lot of creators don't get to see each other except at the big shows.
Right.
So, for example, I was at WonderCon, which was at Anaheim a couple of weeks ago, and I got to see people I haven't seen, honestly, in like 20 years. You know,
wow.
I mean, there was a dude who, it's funny, there's a guy, I looked at his face. His face has not changed. His hair has gotten gray. He's gotten taller. But his face is the exact same it was 20 years ago. And I saw the guy, and I'm like, oh, my God, my friend Jake. We went to Ithaca College together. And I saw him, and it just blew my mind that, you know, how conventions are such a great place for people to reconnect and find friends and make new friends. And one of the things I've learned over the years is one of the reasons I personally have never really bothered a lot of creators at conventions is because those creators don't get to see their friends very often.
No.
So sometimes it's a good idea if you see a group of creators talking, it's not a good idea to go and bother them. Like, let them hang out with their buddies. And, you know, if they get a moment alone, absolutely talk to them. But it's never a good idea to go up to a group of creators who are talking and laughing and just try to jump in it, because you can make yourself look really bad.
Yeah. That's the thing that I love about cons. I love being able to catch up with people, you know, people that, you know, we're talking to each other on Facebook all year, or we're doing things like this, we're recording podcasts, but, you know, we only actually see each other at shows. So it's cool. It's, you know, it's like a little vacation. You know, I love being able to, you know, catch up with guys like you and like Karan Grant and Sanford Green. And I had a very cool time talking with Jason Reeves.
Oh, he's a good guy. I like him.
So it's cool, and I'm really looking forward to it. And you know, because of this is another reason for me to look forward to the whole deal. So again, you know, congratulations. You got my vote. I wish you the best. And it'll be fun. It'll be fun. Hopefully we won't have like this weird like segregated section at the Eisner Awards. we'll have to make sure we actually, you know, integrate with everybody else. It's like, oh no, here we go. There's the black section over there in the corner.
Well, you know what? The funny thing about that is that it might automatically become that by default.
Oh yeah. Yeah, well, it's usually becomes that by default, but, you know, I don't know. We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens.
But, so let's talk about Miranda Mercury, bro.
Oh,
I hear there's a part two.
Oh, there's been a part two for so long, but the exciting news for all you big Miranda Mercury fans, book put out through Arkea a few years ago, volume two, which is going to be subtitled At What Cost, is officially in production. Artist and co-creator Lee Ferguson is drawing pages right this second. I'm expecting a new set to roll through in the next couple of days. And it's been really exciting. I mean, this is something that we've had planned since we did volume one, but just the schedule didn't align right. The timing wasn't right. And we finally have a really decent window in the next, basically till the end of the year, to finish up volume two. Volume two will benefit from all of the critical lessons, all of the critical and sometimes painful lessons that we learned doing volume one. And we're really excited about it. It is going to be, it's going to encompass five issues. It will be episodes 301 through 305.
Nice.
And that was one of the lessons that we learned in volume one, that the book should be shorter. Because last time, I think we basically had about 170 or 171 pages of comics. And that doesn't even include the foreword and the afterword and, you know, all of the cool stuff, the kind of threading through the book. So it's going to be a lot more. It's not going to be short, but it's going to be more compact and it's going to be more focused. We're going to do five issues. We're going to do our first Miranda Mercury two-parter. If any of you guys remember, most of the stories, well, not most. All of the stories were completely self-contained in volume one, though some characters and themes did carry over and show up in different issues. I am about to start writing the first official, you know, two-part Miranda Mercury adventure, and I just came up with the end of it a couple of days ago. So I'm really, really excited to finally get this stuff out there. Production-wise, let's just... you know, without spoiling too much of it, but the end of volume two is going to be, let's just say everyone's not going to be very happy with us at the end of volume two, and to expect some definite, hard, unpleasant resolution to the kind of Miranda has been poisoned by her greatest enemy subplot, which kind of threaded its way through volume one. It's all gonna come to a head here, and it was so important that I'm writing the scripts out of order. So I actually wrote 305 first, and I wrote it a long time ago too, probably
right,
like a year and a half, 2 years ago. I actually did the script to 305 because it's so important emotionally that I just knew if I fucked up 305, nothing else was gonna matter. So I did 305 first, and I felt really good about it. And I felt, and Lee, co-creator and artist, and also our anchor, Mark Deering, gave it a read, and they felt very, very strongly about the ending too. So much, in fact, that it might, you know, I'll just say it. Lee is going to, even though issue 305 has been done and ready for a while, he is going to draw that issue dead last, because he said that he's gonna need some emotional time after he's done drawing that particular script. So it's pretty it comes to a really kind of heavy conclusion, but an interesting conclusion, and I think a spot that will leave us in a great position going forward. And the plan, you know, the plan is always to make this more of a regular thing. I mean, if we had our way, we would put out at least another volume of Miranda Mercury every year. So we're trying to work our way to that goal. So there'll be some news that we'll have to share in the next couple of months. We've officially signed a new colorist for volume two. I'm not going to reveal exactly who they are, but they have done some fantastic work, and I think it'll be a perfect fit going forward. So, you know, expect some new characters, expect some new costumes, and one of the most unpleasant cliffhangers of all. So we're already getting back into the groove now, especially now that that the pencils are actually being produced. You know, it's really kind of taken us to a whole nother level now that it's officially kind of moved out of the Word documents. You know, once it starts being illustrated, it feels like it's actually happening. You know, it feels like it's becoming like a physical, like, part of the world, you know, because it's migrating off of the page. So we're really, really excited about it. Announcements to come. Hopefully we'll have something of significance to announce at San Diego, and you know, keep your eyes open. Follow me on Twitter at Miranda Mercury and at Lee M. Ferguson. He's been posting some kind of you know, process sketches and stuff while he's working pages out. And the MirandaMercury.com site will be getting a redesign in a couple of months. And we're really excited about it. We're really excited to get her back out there. And the stories that we want to tell in volume two are going to be, you know, taking things to the next level in this very important relationship between Miranda and Jack Warning, and kind of, you know, what happens to them and what's ultimately going to happen to Miranda Mercury in the end. So,
well, I want to say absolutely that I'm very happy to hear that you're continuing to do this, because you created a franchise that is desperately needed, which is a black female teen superhero doing amazing things in a future Buck Rogers type universe. I mean, this is just an incredible piece of work you've created. And a lot of people have said it to you. I'm going to say it to you. One of the things that, you know, Brandon Thomas might not know, other than the fact that, you know, people keep confusing us all the time, is that, and I've shared this story many times in the past, but it always bears repeating, that I was a fan of the Ambidextrous column way before I even knew who Brandon Thomas was. I just enjoyed reading some really sharp writing about pop culture from another black male geek, and it really inspired me in a lot of ways to just say, you know what, let me start doing my own stuff. You might not know that, but I'm telling you right now, Ambidextrous was a very, very groundbreaking column, and I'm glad that you did it.
Well, thank you.
I actually purchased a Miranda Mercury comics at Midtown Comics years ago, so I actually have a couple of the original issues of the book.
Those are collector's items.
Yeah, I still got them.
I think the print run on that was like 3,500 or something. So
yeah,
I keep telling people, hold on to it. You know,
oh, believe me, I still got them, bro.
With Miranda in the future, I'm gonna try to make you some money.
Yeah. Well, but honestly, I want to say that you know, thanks for continuing to do it, man, because we need more stuff like what you are, what you've created. And it's original, it's innovative, it's exciting, it's intelligent. I mean, the Upside Down issue blew my mind. I never thought I'd see that in an American comic book.
Oh my God. You know, it was so much work to get that right.
I know. I mean, but
I told you I had nightmares about the book being printed upside down. Like, seriously, before I actually saw when the book had gone off to press, I had nightmares about opening the book at Comic-Con for the first time and like all the fucking pages were upside down. There was actually a cat at Arkea. I forgot what his last. I think his name is Josh Trujillo, something like that. Kid named Josh. He told me that he made it like his personal mission to make sure that the book didn't get messed up because the printer is like, all right, wait, you really want these pages printed upside down? Like this is what you want. So I always have to thank Josh for his diligence and making sure that, you know, the book came out right and it was beautiful. But I seriously had a couple of Miranda Mercury related nightmares about that upside down section being printed the wrong way or the rest of the book was upside down. It was a nightmare, but I'm glad that it came out the way that we kind of imagined it. And right. I'm glad that no one took it from me first, because that Miranda Mercury pitch document went through a lot of hands several years before. And that's in the original pitch. You know, this whole like upside down, you know, right to left thing was in the original pitch. So I was fortunate enough to get it out there and published in time before, you know, somebody else picked up on it. Though I think Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo did something similar in an issue of Batman. I don't know if it was quite as long, but I think they did some flip stuff.
Well, I tell you, bro, that's one in a million, though. Because, first of all, one in a million people would even think about that. And then even one in 10 million would be able to pull it off. And you did it. And that is, I mean, it's any accolades you've received for that probably aren't enough, because you deserved a lot more attention than you got and a lot more light than you got. And this is why we're trying right now to make the changes we're trying to make in the, you know, in this industry, because we have people like you doing remarkable work that sadly flew under the radar and the thing is, you got reviewed by incredible people.
I did.
And
I did.
The thing was, like, fans, fortunate. Right. And I would talk to fans and they're like, well, what's that? I'm like, Jesus Christ. Like, how do you not know, like, you know, it, you know, all right, I'm not going to get into this.
I know, because it's going to be a whole other thing.
Right, but the bottom line is that when number two comes out, you know, you've got my support, you've got me, I will hype it to the top of the mountaintops as much as I can, and I'm pretty sure everybody else out there is going to be, you know, in our circle and outside of our circle, they're going to be fully supporting what you have got to do, what you're doing now. So, you know, God bless you on that one, man.
Thank you. Thank you. We're very proud of what we did in the first volume, and we want to keep it going, and we want to make sure that Miranda Mercury is not overlooked. And we know that some of the scheduling things that we've had over the years has contributed to that. So we're going to do our best to get to a place where Miranda Mercury comics are always coming out. There's always something new that we're producing. So very excited so far. And, you know, I know you can speak to this, but the kind of the worst thing about doing things like this is the fact that you can't tell people when you want to tell people.
Right.
I mean, you find out things, you get assignments, you get opportunities, and you just want to tell everybody. You just want to scream it out. And you know, for whatever reason, you can't do that. So that's kind of one of the things. You know, I wish I could send you guys some pages, but I'm not going to. I'm gonna wait until we get some colors laid down. And
you know what? I can wait. I will wait.
When we introduce, you know, our new colorist, we'll do it with some of their work, and I think people will be very, very excited about what's happening. So, that's pretty much it, man. Miranda Mercury, Volume 2, at what cost? Coming, let's say, we're saying early 2015. And we are very, very anxious to get the next set of adventures out to you guys. And, you know, we have a lot of big plans. I have a lot of scenes that I've had in my head for years and years. So I'm excited to finally be approaching the place where that stuff is going to get out there. So, a lot of work to be done, but it's fun stuff. And, I appreciate all of the kind things that people have said to us about the book. And I appreciate people asking when there's going to be more. And I'm happy to tell you that we are working on more right now. And stay tuned. So that's it.
Yeah.
That's all I got. So.
Oh, do you know when this is going to go up?
Oh, I'm going to put it up early next week. I want it to come out as close to Sunday as possible because of the 4th Be With You stuff.
Awesome. So with that being said, on May 8th and 9th at Cal State Los Angeles, there is EagleCon. And basically, the documentary I've been working on, which was called Brave New Souls, Black Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of the 21st Century, is having its world premiere on Friday, May 9th at around 4 o'clock over at Cal State. So if you get a chance, go on to Facebook and look up EagleCon, like Eagle like the bird, EagleCon at Cal State. It is a public event. It is not free, but it is a two-day convention on Thursday and Friday at Cal State Los Angeles. We got a lot of people showing up for this. There was a lot of people interviewed. I am going to do a part two to the Brave New Souls documentary, which will include Brandon Thomas. So just letting you folks know, if you want to see the volume one of that documentary, it's going to be premiering, the world premiere, at Cal State Los Angeles on Friday, May the 9th.
All right. All right, cool. All right, guys. So, again, sorry we were away for so long. We'll try to be better.
Yes.
But we have a lot of cool, exciting things going on in the background. And in a few months, you'll probably know exactly why we weren't able to record nearly as many of these as we wanted to. But we thank you for your patience. We thank you for your support. And exciting times. It's just exciting times, I think, for both of us. And hopefully we'll run into a lot of you on the con circuit. Specifically at San Diego Comic-Con. I don't know if, are you making it out to New York this year?
I always go to New York Comic-Con. I'm going to try to get Brave New Soul screen there.
Oh, okay.
The problem is that unlike the folks at San Diego Comic-Con and WonderCon, the people who run New York Comic-Con are very hard. They only accept 25% of submissions, and that's panels and screenings. So I don't know. I mean, I've submitted a panel every year there for the last 5 years, have not gotten one approved. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what's going to happen.
I don't know. I think they don't have nearly as much space as I think San Diego does.
I disagree because the Jacob Javits Center is huge. Mm-hmm. I just think that they don't use the space they have correctly.
Right.
Know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's a mismanagement of space. So, but you're right. I mean, it's not as big as San Diego. And as we know, San Diego Comic Convention Center has been having problems too with space.
Yes. You know? And I believe they're scheduled to do some additions to that in the next few years. So.
Good.
You know. That'll be a long time coming though. But seriously, if anxious to see you and talk to you and meet some of you while we're at the shows, and when we get a little closer, obviously schedules and stuff will be posted up. And I guess there might be a possibility that there's a Two Brandons panel, maybe. I don't know. We'll see. So
did you send in the info? If not, okay. I'll send it in, bro, because I have the application for them.
Okay, you do. Yeah, because you've done panels before. They're going to be like, who is this dude? Like, we don't even know who he is. Or maybe I'll send it in and they'll be like, oh, this is Easton. He did that panel with us last year.
Last few years.
Like, people were like sitting on the floor and stuff because the room wasn't big enough.
Right.
So, yeah. So we'll see. But thank you for your support. And you know, we will see you guys soon.
Take care. All right.